Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated weekly design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. This week, we're in Singapore to discover what the Lion City can teach the world about doing a lot with a little in the fields of fashion, architecture, product design and city building. First, we mull over urban greenery and what this teeny state at the tip of the Malaysian Peninsula can teach the world about building sustainably.
Greenery can help reduce ambient temperatures, it can actually help absorb excess rainwater, it can help counteract noise. Greenery has more than aesthetic benefit, it has an environmental and an economic benefit.
We also turn our hand to ceramics with a design-minded duo that's showing there's still a market for craft in the city-state.
When a bowl or a plate that's made with our hands, it's more than just money exchange. When we hand it to someone else and it becomes their morning coffee cup or their noodle bowl or their muesli bowl, and it's a daily thing.
Then we meet the pair behind some of the city's finest and most inviting architecture, plus meet the fashion designer whose work is a cut above the rest. All that coming up right here on Section D's Singapore special on Monocle 24. Singapore is a diminutive city that's better known for its financial clout, stern rules and ease of living than its design chops. But the city's smallness and the density of its population make it an archetype for urbanists looking to explore what the city-state can teach us about sustainability. As an outspoken broadcaster and TV personality, architect Jason Pomeroy is a familiar face in Singapore. In fact, you may recognise him from his series City Time Traveller or the four-part documentary City Redesign. He's also the founder and principal of Pomeroy Studio, an urbanism architecture, design and research practice behind some of Singapore's most exciting new developments. He gives us the lay of the land in terms of Singapore's built environment and suggests how other nations can learn from the Little Red Dot's unique take on green space and city building.
What's kind of bizarre, if you will, is that I kind of grew up in the leafy confines of the United Kingdom, whereby there was plenty of green space to go out and kind of play. And it always kind of made me think as a child, you know, how do people play in high density environments like in Singapore, like in Kuala Lumpur? Being half English, half Malaysian, I was kind of shuttling between the two places during the summer times. When I went to Cambridge to study, I did my thesis on the role of sky courts and sky gardens as these kind of pleasurable environments whereby people can go and play. And it was just a wonderful twist of fate that I'd eventually end up in Singapore, which is, should I say, less of a garden city now, but more of a city in a garden, whereby sky courts and sky gardens are those alternative social spaces. Now, what I find curious is that it is kind of a testbed of new ideas, and Singapore is rapidly urbanizing to cater for the expansion in its population from 5 million to 6 million people. And what we're finding is that with urbanization, with population increase, and the fact that half the world's populations are living in inner city centers and will increase to 70% by 2050, Singapore is very much a focus of many global cities to see how they can react to such urbanization. So what I like is that some of those initial ideas that my studio have been sort of propagating is really coming to fruition. You only have to look at Marina Bay Sands as an example, you know, 1.2 acre of sky park, equivalent to having 4.5 jumbo jets lined sort of, you know, nose to tail as an alternative social space. And when you think about the urban greenery properties, the fact that greenery can help reduce ambient temperatures, it can actually help absorb excess rainwater, it can actually help counteract noise reverberation, we can start to say that greenery has more than an aesthetic benefit. It has an environmental and an economic benefit.
So Singapore celebrated its 51st birthday this summer, I believe.
That's right.
And it's not very well known that Lee Kuan Yew, the former man at the helm of things, actually selected a lot of the trees which we see around us. He hand-selected the species that he wanted to be part of the city. He very much wanted it to be a city that embraced greenery and that gave people these kind of spaces. But, you know, arguably that's only happened over the past few years. Could you trace a very quick line drawing of how Singapore's done at increasing its urban greenery and with its urban greenery projects over the past few decades?
Yeah. Well, obviously, you know, Lee Kuan Yew certainly had green fingers and he certainly like the idea of having the National Parks Board almost kind of like a phone call away. He was sort of critical in trying to strategically plan urban greenery throughout Singapore. It's kind of interesting that when you think about kind of taking the effort to kind of foreplan, it's so easy for us as designers or legislators to kind of say, don't worry, we'll leave it to the next generation to worry about that. When I think about kind of Holland and their ability to kind of look at wind turbine technology very early on, they're now having the benefits of looking at a renewable energy source to kind of power their communities. Similarly, he had the foresight to kind of lay down the sort of structure to say, we plant now and we can appreciate the benefits 51 years on. So what we can see is that that initial kind of foray into strategic planting of the green corridors, looking at kind of replenishing urban greenery at the same rate as we are kind of planting our kind of concrete and glass and steel structures, we're now starting kind of to reap the benefits. And then when you look at kind of newer legacy projects like Gardens by the Bay, I think it kind of demonstrates that the Singapore government realized that in order to kind of be a green, sustainable city, one needs to kind of embrace greenery, not just for the aesthetics, but also for the environmental benefits. And you're dealing with an incredibly hot tropical climate. What we find is that the legacy that he laid down is also providing a means of reducing ambient temperatures. If you kind of feel the temperature difference between the Botanic Gardens and the Central Business District, you can actually feel, you know, a temperature difference of anything between 3 and 4 degrees centigrade. By putting greenery into the city, you're helping reduce ambient temperatures, meaning that we can actually have a lower energy bill. So to have that foresight, to think about not only the aesthetics, but the environmental benefits is actually quite encouraging. And I think that that's the legacy that kind of lives on.
So you've mentioned the Botanic Gardens, you've mentioned the Gardens by the Bay, and as we look around, we can just about see Marina Bay Sands as well. Yeah. These projects are beautiful projects enforced by a strong government able to get things done. It's not about tendering the process, it's not about keeping everyone happy.
Yeah.
This government is able to get things done, which is truly admirable. But none of those projects are residential, none of those projects really address the problem of dense living. I wonder if you could cast your architect's eye over the skyline of Singapore and tell me about some projects that you really see making waves or making changes aesthetically, sure, yes, to improve people's lives, yeah, yes, but also in terms of the quite gritty challenges that Singapore and other cities are facing.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no denying that when you've suddenly got a situation where half to maybe three quarters of the population in the world will be living in inner city centres, housing is always going to be of prime concern. What that means is that the open spaces that one would be able to use for social interaction, recreation, amenity, they're effectively vanishing and they're being urbanized. They're being sort of having buildings dropped onto them. What we find is that there is an increasing privatization of space, which is frustrating to say the least. What it means is that we are shrinking back into the coffee shop, we're going into the hotel lobby, we're going into the retail mall as a means of our recreation and amenity. And, you know, one thing that really bugs the hell out of me is watching people running around in the public domain playing Pokemon Go. Actually, they should be out there socially interacting and having conversations rather than just kind of glued to their kind of iPhones and Samsungs. Now, the thing is, we need to be able to replenish the loss of that open space to encourage people to kind of develop those soft social skills again. Otherwise, we will become creatures of technology. And what that means is that sky courts and sky gardens in high-density environments could be the answer. For me, I think that the sky court and sky garden is a bit like the modern urban vocabulary of the street and the square. If you and I used to be able to interact in the street and the square, in the future, with urbanization, with increasing privatization of space, we'll have to go somewhere else to have a chat. So look at the Pinnacle in Tanjong Pagar, classic example, 12 towers interlinked by sky courts, interlinked by sky gardens. People don't have to go down to the ground and try and find space. They can be running around at the rooftop. They can be going to grab a glass of wine and sort of looking at the sunset. It's also a means of recreation for outside of the community as well. So people can actually get up to the rooftop deck and actually get a nice view of the city. So what we're seeing in the residential arena is a lot of buildings that are incorporating these social spaces because, frankly, there is no space on the ground and the spaces are on the ground are becoming privatized. Just go to Clark Quay, for example. That's not a public space anymore. That's a privatized space. That's a new food and beverage environment for people to hang out. I mean, it feels public. It's questionable whether I could have a political rally or a religious sermon, which is what you could do in public space, but what it demonstrates is that there is this public domain characteristics. It feels public, but actually a corporation is controlling it and controlling the use. They're basically saying, from this time to this time, you can use it as a food and beverage destination, but be sure you can't get up on your soapbox and have a conversation about what you want to say.
Jason Pomeroy there, the architect, founder and principal of Pomeroy Studio in Singapore. We met at BEX Asia, a trade show on sustainable building at Marina Bay Sands. Next, we check in on the state of Singapore's often overlooked craft scene and throw a few pots with a pair of makers turning their hand to ceramics. Michelle Lim and Ng Siok Ha founded Mudrock in 2013 and moved to their studio on an unassuming street of hardware shops and karaoke bars in Jalan Besar last year. Far from a romantic folly, the pair's pottery business has found favour with private customers and restaurants alike. The pair were also asked to complete work for Singapore's High Commission as a ceremonial gift for Great Britain's Queen Elizabeth II. Singapore may be resource poor and craft light, but there is a growing customer base for those keen to take home a genuine piece of design. Monocle's Ziana Zulkifli headed to the studio to find out more.
I'm tapping the rim of the bowl to hear the resonance. And if there is going to be a resonance, then it means that the work is good, it's sound. I'm Michelle Lim, and I am the creative director of Mudrock, also known as Head Potter number 2.
Hi, I'm Siok, Ng Siok Ha, and I'm the other founder of Mudrock.
If you go to Potter's studio, you hear this sound a lot.
Tell me a little about what you do here at your ceramics studio.
I would say that we are primarily a handmade production studio for ceramics. We do a lot of production for restaurants, homes, so anyone who needs a mass of plates and cups, bowls, we are the people to find in Singapore. And occasionally, we also teach.
And you said that you're primarily a production pottery studio. Is there a steady supply? Who are your typical clients?
Okay. We have been quite lucky. When we went into this and we decided to do this full-time, we already knew that this local handmade supply for ceramics is lacking. So since coming in, we've had a steady supply of clients, restauranteurs, hoteliers, art consultants, restaurant consultants who will pass our name to every new restaurant coming up. We did one for Queen Elizabeth, her 90th birthday, just recently. And this was a commission by the Singapore government, Ministry of Foreign Affairs. They were looking for a present for the Queen's 90th birthday and they were scratching their head. And somehow someone came to us and asked us, you know, would you like to make something? Can you propose something? And we thought, yeah, it was such an honour. And we thought immediately, tea set, because the Queen, you know, English, they drink tea, and we're ceramic artists. We just thought it was really apt to bring the two together.
Shall we take a walk around the studio and you can give me a little tour?
Yeah, sure. These are what we call pottery wheels that are electronically driven. And this is where we make bowls, plates, cups, anything that's symmetrical, vases. I think what a lot of people know at pottery as is this scene where someone sits on the wheel, they sculpt clay into a symmetrical round form. The most conjured image is Demi Moore and Patrick Swayze's movie Ghost. Yeah, so this is what you have here on the wheel. This is what we also call the sauna because of the kilns being turned on. The temperature rises in this room. We have 4 electric kilns and 1 gas kiln here. The difference between the kilns, gas and electric, is really the texture, the colours, and the treatment that you want on the finished product. Over here on the other side is our glaze lab, and you'll find that they are tubs of minerals like strontium, dolomite, whiting, silica, all these things that might not really make a lot of sense, but you've probably seen them in your periodic chart. So this is where the chemistry happens. And another side that people don't see in ceramics, they see the very romantic sculpting of a bowl, very sensual. But to make it beautiful, to make the colours come out, is where the chemistry comes in. It's a very specific mixture of minerals and mixing it with water and then applying it on the raw clay work before we put it into the kiln. That's the magic, I guess. That's the end magic, yeah.
So it takes really weeks and weeks to get, you know, a very precise colour. We thought it would be an uphill task, but instead, we realised that it's really quite in huge demand. People have been searching and searching. They've been travelling to buy unique crockery, and then they realised that, hey, we have it in our backyard, and just, they've been just very supportive. And also because the buying experience as compared to IKEA is quite different when you come to a handmade shop. So over time, we've made great friends. And I think it's that simple sharing when a bowl or a plate that's made with our hands, and it's more than just money exchange. When we hand it to someone else and it becomes either their morning coffee cup or, you know, their noodle bowl or their muesli bowl, and it's a daily thing.
Singapore is not known for makers, not known as producers. A craft like ceramics is always something that is imported, like it's from the West, it's from China. If you want to do ceramics, go overseas.
It's from Japan.
Yeah. But not knowing that we have a really rich and rather deep culture and heritage in ceramics, for example, or woodcraft. And we have legacies like that from places such as the Dragon Kilns and things that have been demolished. So we have that in us. And I think it's important for new makers and people to rise up in the manufacturing area in the little ways they can. And this is our way, so that we can inspire the next generation.
Michelle Lim and Ng Seok Ha, the founders of Mudrock Ceramics there, spinning some yarns and some bowls to myself and Monocle's Ziana Zulkifli. If I asked you to name a Singaporean fashion designer, you might stumble. But one studio we think you should be well aware of is that of Priscilla Shunmugam. From her airy atelier cum showroom in Chitby Gardens, a colonial-era estate in the well-heeled Holland Village area, Shunmugam turns out tasteful women's wear made from Southeast Asian textiles under her brand Ong Shunmugam. Monocle's Ziana Zulkifli visited the shop to find out more and how Singapore's fashion scene is finally beginning to flourish.
We're very excited about this space. It's a flagship for a reason. We have basically done something that I don't think has been done in the retail industry here. So it's a slight mix of nervousness and excitement.
How did you come up with this idea where you wanted to open up the workshop space and let people look into your process?
From the customer's perspective, we sort of wanted to transplant an open kitchen concept. If we could allow our production staff to look into the retail store to see how customers were reacting to the products, how customers were fitting the clothes, I thought that would just enable every single department to really understand how each person works and just keep a conversation alive and going. When you come in, you're going to see a retail front, but maybe one of the first things you notice is a glass window and it looks into another frontier, and that's basically our production studio. We've got our production team of four full-time staff, and they make every single piece right from design all the way to the finishing points. I think my single biggest motivation for that was to basically educate. I think that fashion, the world over, not just in Singapore, is facing a bit of a crunch point because the business of fashion as we know it, in the manufacturing of fashion as we know it, and even the calendars changed so much in the past 5 years that people have begun to have a very different idea of what it's like to make clothing. And I felt that if we hid it somewhere in an industrial park, you know, somewhere out in MacPherson or Ubi or Jurong, we would save some costs for sure, but we would be disabling people from understanding the full vertical process of what it takes to make a garment. And I felt if we could educate them, if we could show them we would get closer to changing their perceptions towards dressmaking. I think that that would highly influence the way they consumed our products and appreciated the value behind them.
So what is it like being a fashion designer in Singapore?
Being a fashion designer in Singapore is tough simply because when you couple hurdles like high operating costs, a lack of resources, labor crunch, a lack of skilled workers, you also have a very skeptical audience, you know. So you still have consumers in this part of the world who very much value something that originates from the West. So if you're going to put something out there and put a premium price tag on it, there's a big mental barrier. Here we are, you know, a young Singapore-based Southeast Asian fashion brand in the 21st century, and we want to project what it means to be Asian in this time, in this day, in this age. So although I want these sentiments to come through, I don't want to rely on the usual suspects, you know, the low-hanging fruit. So basically I said no Peranakan tiles, for example, no rosewood furniture. We have to go beyond that.
Okay, so here we are. This is our production studio, and our team is here.
So you have your drafter that drafts the patterns, then you have your cutter who cuts the fabric, and then we have our seamstresses here. The both of them will basically construct the actual garments using a combination of the sewing machine, mechanical stitching, as well as hand stitching. Yeah. So over here we have Jasmine, and Jasmine is our drafter.
Hello.
And as you can see, she's got a computer screen in front of her where she is basically drafting patterns using CAD software. So a drafter is a very important person because it's the drafter who will translate a 2D drawing into a 3D pattern. So drafting the patterns on the screen, she then checks them through a smart board here. And once they're fully accurate and she's satisfied with them, she will print them out using this 2-meter plotter onto this white, thick paper. Okay, so once the patterns are printed out, they're good to go. And then they get transferred over to the cutting department, headed by Kim Hua. So Kim Hua is our cutter. And a cutter is essentially that. The cutter cuts. I'm very hopeful for the design scene in Singapore and in Greater Asia. I think when you look at matured societies like Japan and Korea, you know this can very well happen. It's not impossible. It's just going to take a bit of time. It's going to take a village, and it's going to take very consistent effort. And that's what I'm trying. If anything, I hope that that's what this brand and myself can do.
Priscilla Shumnagum, founder of fashion label Ong Shumnagum, there speaking to our very own Zayana Zulkifli. Next up, we check in with an architecture practice that's setting a high benchmark for hospitable design. Since 2006, partners Mark Webb and Naoko Takanuchi's tasteful but homely interiors have been in high demand and can be seen from the White Rabbit restaurant at Dempsey Hill to the high-end Tippling Club, not to mention PTT Family's new Katamama Hotel in Bali. I visited Takanuchi Webb's office in a colonial-era bungalow on the leafy Wessex estate to find out more about how this British architect and Japanese interior designer developed their much-admired style.
Naoko and I started off working for other architects in Singapore, and 10 years ago we thought there was a great opportunity for us to develop our own practice here. So from our backgrounds, we really wanted to concentrate in the restaurant and F&B business. So we started off doing a project for Lo and Behold, which is very forward-thinking F&B group here. Our first project for them was White Rabbit, which was converting a church into a restaurant. And since then, we've done quite a few projects with them as well.
And tell me a little bit about the Singapore hospitality scene. I suppose it would be easy for detractors to say that it might feel a little bit stuffy compared to some other Western countries, it might feel far ahead of some Asian countries. Is there a particular, I don't know, vernacular, a particular style, a particular Singaporean way that you design these things? Or is the fact that both of you are from different countries testament to the fact Singapore is a bit of a melting pot of styles? What do you think about that?
It's very much a melting pot of styles. There is a lot of history here that you kind of uncover. I mean, people do think of Singapore as being this bright, shiny city, but yeah, you come to our office and this area, you can see there's a lot of different layers, and there is a history to it, even though it's a very young country. We do take in our projects a lot of inspiration from the buildings we work on, and we've been quite fortunate in having a lot of heritage buildings to work on as well. I think maybe having a foreign perspective as well initially kind of helped us out in, you know, maybe seeing things in a different way.
And Mark, you seem like an incredibly modest man, so this might be hard for you to answer, but, you know, to what would you attribute the success that you've had so far in the F&B industry? When you see a space, when you see one of these heritage buildings that you mentioned, what is it that you think about? What are your first considerations as an architect, as a designer of space, and as a designer of places and things within them? What do you think about when you start a project, and what do you think about your approach has been taken up in this way?
Whatever the project we take on, whatever the building, we always have a similar approach, talking to the client initially to get their brief, and then a big influence for us is the site. We spend a lot of time analyzing the site, and I think for all F&B projects, a big component is the practicality of it, how, you know, it has to work as a space and as a business. So that's a strong component that we look at. We are a small office, so we're both very involved in every aspect of whatever design we take on. So I think that our attention to detail is something we really pride and take care of.
So you've done a number of projects here in Singapore, but you're not limited to these shores, are you? You've done some work, you mentioned the Lo and Behold Group, but also then for the PTT Group behind the Potato Head properties, of which they have one here, one in Hong Kong, and the hotel in Bali, the Katamama. Do you have any plans to move beyond Singapore, or do you like your project to be here, close to home?
Actually, for us, it is a great mix to be able to have a foot in each place, actually. I mean, the benefit of having projects in Singapore is actually the size of Singapore. When we have a project in sight, we can be at site in 10 minutes to kind of check up on everything. So the small size of the country, in a way, is beneficial for quality control. And then for our being in the region, we're very much excited and looking to kind of do bigger projects overseas as well.
That was Mark Webb and Naoko Takanuchi, founders of Takanuchi Webb, speaking to me from their Singapore headquarters in Wessex Village. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. My very special thanks to our ever-patient editor, Alex Funnell, the show's producers this week, Henry Rees-Sheridan and Ziana Zulkifli. If you have any comments or queries, then feel free to drop Henry a note at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back at the same time next week. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes. And please do leave us a review on the latter. You can also, if you're so inclined, download our sister show, On Design, where we dedicate a few minutes each week to delving deeper into a person, place, or idea that's shaping the design industry. This week's not-to-be-missed installment comes from Monocle 24's Yolene Goffin, who mulls over Antwerp's legendary Royal Academy of Fine Arts. But for now, you've been listening to Section D. I'm Josh Fennett. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.